here to take your worthless life." But Sanandi raised a hand, gesturing for the guards to be at ease. "Advice is permissible," she said, "though I must add that anyone who goes to Gujara to be healed with magic will never be permitted to return to Kiswa. This has always been our law." "I care nothing for your laws," Ahiru snapped. Then he turned and started forward into the crowd again. They parted down the middle, making a path. Sunandi sighed, no doubt, reading Ahiru's anger in the stiff set of his broad shoulders. Najiri threw her a glare of his own and then started after Ahiru. After a moment and one last signal to the guards, she joined him. "Whatever you might think," she said in a low voice, "I stopped him to save his life." Najiri snorted. "He allowed you to stop him to save yours." "What?" He gestured around at the crowd, which had begun to murmur and shift, anguish and anger on many faces. "Look at these people, Speaker. They are Hananja's faithful, and they came to see her highest servant. If those guards had attacked him, do you think any force short of the gods themselves could have stopped their wrath?" She stumbled to a halt. He kept walking, too angry to care whether the crowd closed in and tore her apart in that moment. But he heard her sandals clap on the stones behind him as she jogged to catch up. And reluctantly, he forced himself to think of his mother, as Ahiru had taught him. That cooled his anger, and he slowed down for her. "It would seem I've spent too many years studying foreigners, and not enough with my own people," she said, sounding chagrined. He took it for her version of an apology. "You see them more clearly than I. People everywhere are the same. All people except him." From the corner of his eye, he saw her nod toward Ahiru's back. Najiri smiled, lifting his head proudly. "True. All people except him." Following along in Ahiru's wake, they passed through the last of the crowd and returned to Sanandi's house. Chapter 32. It is the sound of screaming that wakes the child, Ahiru. For a moment he lies on his bed, listening to the chorus of his brother's breath, and wondering if the sound is the remnant of some dream. But he dismisses that thought, for he never forgets his dreams. And just a moment before he was skimming above the Greenlands, near Kaitian. There were no screams then, just the hollow rush of the wind and the pennant flap of his loin drapes. He remembers the tickling caress of barley hairs against his skin, the fermenting smell of hot mud in the irrigation canals, the sun on his back, the sear blue sky. In the past, he has dived into the mud to see what it feels like. Once it tried to drown him, but he is a proper child of Gujara. He proclaimed his soul name, "I am Ensha," and took hold of the dream so that the mud became like the womb he remembers only when he is asleep, harmless and enveloping and profoundly comforting. But now the dream is gone, and he lies in the real world, where he is just a little boy, and his heart is full of sudden fear. He sits up. Several of his brothers do the same. This is the chamber where the youngest of the prince's sons sleep. Tehamau has seen 7 floods of the river and is oldest, but it is Ahiru to whom the other boys look. He is only 5, and does not understand that they see a peculiar wisdom in him. He merely accepts it. "Goddess touched," their tutors call it. "Blessed with the gift," said the priest who came to Kaitian a few days before to examine him. He gave Ahiru a necklace with an intriguing pendant, an ovoid of polished obsidian etched with a stylized moon tear. "Before 40 days have passed, you shall join us," the priest told him then. "You are a child of the Hetewa now." Ahiru knows this is foolish. He is the child of his mother, and the father he rarely sees but loves anyhow. And perhaps this Hananja, of whom he has heard so much. but he fingers the pendant now and shivers as a flicker of foreboding moves through him. Getting out of bed, he whispers to his brothers that they should find some place to hide. He will go see what is happening. Tehemau insists on accompanying him, mostly to save face. Ehuru nods, even though Tehemau wets the bed and sometimes, after a nightmare, weeps like an infant. Ehuru wishes one of their older brothers were here, an Inket who is kind and knows the best stories, or perhaps the warrior, Tiaset. But Tehemau's presence will be a comfort, at least. He and Tehemau slip into the corridor and run from one drape and flowering vase to another. Ahead is a solarium where usually they can find several of their mothers lounging on couches and cushions, chatting or playing dicing games, drawing letters or checking over figuring scrolls, a place of busy peace. Instead, they find the aftermath of chaos, tables and couches overturned, cushions thrown to the floor, dice scattered. Tehemau starts to call out for his mother, and Ehuru shushes him instinctively. They hear another scream nearby, followed by something stranger, sharp men's voices, deeper and rougher than those of the eunuchs who normally serve in the prince's springtime palace. The palace guards are never allowed inside, unless their father has come to visit. Is that what has happened? But if so, then why do the men sound angry? They peer around the corner and see. Two of their mothers lie on the floor, unmoving, their fine clothing dark with spreading blood. Another cringes on a couch nearby, nearly gibbering as she asks why. The soldiers ignore her. They are arguing among themselves. One of them wants to spare her, long enough to enjoy, but the others are insisting that they follow orders. The argument ends abruptly when one of the men spits on the floor and thrusts his sword through the mother's throat. She stops gibbering and stares at him in surprise, blood bubbling over her lips. Then she sags backward. Tehemau screams. The soldiers see them. Tehemau gets farther than Ehuru because his legs are longer. One soldier grabs Ehuru by his sidelock and yanks him backward so hard that his vision blurs. He cries out and falls. Fear slows all that follows. Through a haze of pain tears, he sees another soldier tackle Tehemau to the ground, cursing as the boy struggles wildly. When the soldier draws his knife, it catches light from the colored lanterns. So does Tehemau's blood, arcing forth and spreading over the marble after the soldier draws the knife across his throat. Ehuru does not cry out, not even when the soldier dragging him stops and draws his own knife. It curves gracefully upward, casting blurred rainbows like the dreaming moon. "Wait," says one of the other men, catching the hand that holds the knife. "I thought you wanted a woman," laughs the one that holds Ehuru. "No, look," the soldier points, and another makes an exclamation of surprise. And Ehuru knows that they have seen the Hedua's pendant dangling around his neck. "Take him to the captain," says the first. The one holding him sheathes his knife and hauls Ehuru up by his hair. "Try to escape and I'll kill you anyway," he says. Ehuru hears but does not respond. His eyes are locked on Tehemau, who has stopped moving now. Tehemau has wet himself again, Ehuru notices. Through the fear, he feels sorrow, for wherever his soul has gone now, Tehemau is probably ashamed. The soldiers drag Ehuru through the corridors where his mother's talk and music once echoed, intermingled with the siblings' chatter and play. Now the corridors are filled with the sounds and smells of death. The scenes drift past slowly, like so many minstrel plays. In the corridor, he sees several of his oldest brothers dead. Tiaset lies face down among them, with a broken lantern pole in his hands, a warrior to the end. As they pass the atrium garden, Ehuru can hear strange grunting sounds, Through the leaves he sees one of his mothers struggling beneath a soldier who is hurting, but not killing her. Ehru's soldiers see this and resume their bickering as they drag him along. They pass one of the girls' sleeping chambers, and there Ehru sees many bodies. It was their screaming that woke Ehru and his brothers. At last they reach the grand hall. Here the soldiers stop before a man who wears more red and gold than they do. The man stoops to examine Ehru's pendant. "He is not yours," cries a voice, and this one wakes Ehru from his stupor. His own mother. He turns, ignoring the pain this causes his scalp, to see her emerge from a side corridor. She wears a brightly colored brocade wrap and the gold amber necklace that Ehru's father gave her. She is regal and unafraid. Soldiers immediately take her by the arms, dragging her forward. She barely seems to notice their presence. "I have given my son to the Hedua," she declares to the captain. "Harm him and risk the goddess's own wrath." The captain scowls at this and orders the men to kill her. The world slows again. Two knives go into her at breast and belly, then again at neck and side. The men step back. Ehru lunges forward, not caring if he loses his scalp. But fortunately, the soldier's grip has loosened, and he slips free only a few hairs the less. He reaches her as she falls, stumbling in his effort to catch her, and failing. She lands hard enough to bounce, but then lies still, her hands drifting to the floor at her sides, her eyes fixing on his. She is smiling. He skids to his knees beside her. The floor is slippery with her blood. Her wrap clings to his hands when he takes hold of it in an effort to pull her upright. "Do not weep," she whispers. Blood is on her lips. He screams something. He does not know what. "Do not weep," she commands again. She lifts her hand to touch his face, drawing a wet line down one cheek. "This is how it must be. You will be safe now. Ananja herself will protect you. You are her son now." And then she stops talking. Her hand drops. Her eyes are still fixed on his, but different somehow. He is still screaming when the soldiers drag him back. They ignore him. They are upset, frightened for some reason. "No way to know she was the first wife," the captain says. He sounds shaken. "So many women here, no way to know. That's what we'll tell him." "And the brat?" "The Hedua, where else? Do you want to be the one who explains to the gatherers how he died?" No one answers. "We'll deliver him on the way back to Yanya Eon. As far as tonight is concerned, he wasn't here." So they carry Ehru outside and truss him up and strap him across a saddle like baggage. And once the killing is done, they ride away with him into the desert night. And as they dump him on the Hedua steps and leave him there for the sentinels to collect, he recalls the old priest's words and realizes that they were not an error but a prophecy. Now, though he would never have chosen it, he is a child of the Hedua, now and forevermore. Ehru opened his eyes and lifted his head from his knee. Sunandi's garden surrounded him, wilder and thicker than Gujarin gardens tended to be, although no less beautiful. Straightening from the awkward posture, he stretched out his leg and sighed, looking up at the dreamer through the graceful branches of a Shimanantu tree. He'd come to meditate, but the humid warmth of Kisawa's nights had lulled him into sleep, and memories instead. Not the wisest thing to sleep outdoors and without screening cloth. He scratched one leg and grimaced as he felt a four of insect bites beneath his fingers. Then he tensed, hearing a footstep behind him. "Is your bed not to your satisfaction, gatherer?" He relaxed and turned to see Sunandi. She stood a few feet away on the porch that was the garden's entrance. She wore only a light shift, momentarily throwing him back to the fateful night of their meeting in Yanya Eon that now seems so long ago. "The bed is fine," he replied. "Gatherers don't sleep at night. And yet you have the look of a man who's just woken from a fine nap." "I'm not quite a gatherer any longer," he thought, but did not say. She probably knew it anyhow. "Where's your little killer?" Eiru shook his head. "In Inakarek, though his body is in your guest room with my Jungisa holding him in sleep. He would be awake too if not for that, worrying over all our troubles."
Yes, she sighed.
"I'm glad to know that gatherers, too, have sleepless nights. Makes you seem more human." "I could say the same of ambassadors," he said, turning to look up at the dreamer again. Waking moon peeked around the curve of her larger sister, a signal of the coming dawn. "Someone in your profession must see so much evil, day in and day out. It surprises me to see that you can still be troubled by anything enough that it disturbs your sleep." "A matter of degree, gatherer." She walked down the steps, coming to stand on the grass beside him. "Everyday evils are nothing to me, true. But this war is so much more than that." She hesitated, then added in a tone of resignation, "Perhaps I should be glad that I won't live to become so jaded." He sighed up at the moons. "You sought to prevent war. There's no corruption in that." He sensed her surprise and sudden attention in the moment of silence that followed. "Even if my methods—" "Corruption is a disease of the soul, not the actions, Jay Kalawe. And though the latter are often symptomatic of the former, it is a gatherer's duty to see beyond superficialities. When I return to Gujara, I'll inform the council of my judgment." He glanced back at her. "See to it that you never grow corrupt enough to accept evil without losing sleep, however, or it will be dangerous for you to enter Gujara again." She exhaled, 4 days of tension released in that one sound, and closed her eyes for a moment, perhaps sending a prayer of thanks to whatever gods she respected, or perhaps just savoring life anew. But when she opened her eyes, the old irreverence was there. "Be sure you tell your apprentice, too, priest. He doesn't like me." In spite of his mood, Eiru smiled. "Najiri has little experience with foreigners or women. You confuse him. And that which confuses must be destroyed? Or understood. But you, Sunandi J. Kalawe, are a difficult woman to understand under the best of circumstances. You can't blame Najiri for throwing up his hands and deciding to kill you as the simplest solution to the matter." She laughed low and rich. He watched her, obliquely fascinated by the sound and the long, graceful lines of her neck. "He wouldn't be the first man to come to that conclusion," she said, looking up at the moons. "The prince seems to have felt the same way, and Kinja often joked about it." She fell silent then, abruptly, and he remembered that she was still in mourning. "This Kinja," he said. He gazed at the dreamer as he said it, but he caught her look from the corner of his eye, sensed her sudden tension. He kept his tone soft, trying to convey that he meant only to comfort her. "Will you tell me of him, since it seems he died trying to save both our lands?" She was silent for a length of time. It was very Gujarine of her, though Eiru suspected she would not appreciate the description. "He was," she began slowly, "well, my father, officially by adoption. But in truth, he was more like you are to Najiri, an older brother, a mentor, a friend. I loved him the same way that boy loves you." She paused, then glancing at him. "Perhaps not in quite the same way, though. I never wanted Kinja as a lover." "Even if you had, he would have loved you too much to indulge your desire," Eiru replied evenly. "A father has power over a woman that no lover should have, after all, and vice versa." He shrugged. "This Kinja seems an honorable man, and honorable men
are not so selfish. Perhaps you should say this to your apprentice priest.
Ehuru shook his head slowly and brushed away a persistent biting insect.
I've known Najiri since he was a child. Nothing stops him or dissuades him once he sets his mind on a thing. That will make him a good gatherer. And then, because the moment seemed to demand a degree of candor, he added, "And I'm selfish enough to want his love, for whatever time I have left. I won't abuse it, but I'm not strong enough to turn it away, either. Perhaps you'll think less of me for that."
She sighed and hunkered down to crouch beside him, arms wrapped around her knees.
"No, I don't think less of you. Embrace love while you have it, priest. From whichever direction it comes, proper or improper, for however long it lasts, because it always, always comes to an end." Her pain, her aching loneliness was almost more than Ehuru could bear. He wanted so badly to touch her, stroke away her sorrow and administer peace in its wake, but he dared not. His desire for her was dangerously strong already. Then, too, he realized, sadly, he could not spare the dream blood. His mind was consuming what he'd taken from the soldier far too quickly. Well, there were other ways to share peace.
"I'm no woman," Ehuru said. "I won't have the strength to travel on my own, once I dwell permanently in Inakarek. But before that, if I have the opportunity, I'll seek out this Kinja and tell him what a lucky man he is."
A small tremor passed through her, and her face twitched.
"Thank." But she could not complete the phrase. Tears welled in her eyes abruptly. Ehuru looked away and fell silent to allow her that much privacy. After a moment, she took a deep breath and said in a calmer tone, "The boy says you mean to, take up permanent residence in Inakarek soon."
"Yes, I must." He lowered his eyes. "I'm no longer fully in control of my mind, Jay Kalawe. Even this moment is just an island of lucidity in the flood of madness that surrounds me. In truth, you shouldn't be alone with me. It isn't safe. The boy doesn't fear you. But you should. Even he should." He sighed, watching the garden's shadows shift in a breeze.
"No."
To Ehuru's surprise, he felt Sanandi's hand cover his. "In the desert you endured days of madness, when you could easily have taken me. That's not the way of a murdering beast, no matter what you did to that soldier. And as you say, gatherer, sometimes, no matter how horrid the outcome, we must judge a person by his intentions rather than his actions." And then, to his greater shock, she leaned in and kissed him. It lasted only a breath, just long enough for him to taste the merest hint of her berry dark, rose-petal-soft lips. He had never kissed a woman before. Later he would recall the scent of whatever oil she'd put on after her bath, the sound of her breathing, an impression of cinnamon on the tip of his tongue, the feel of her hand on his, and the softness of her breast against his arm. Later he would imagine pulling her closer, regret that he would never know the fulfillment of such thoughts, and be glad, at least, that he'd had the chance to experience this in his last days of waking. Then she pulled back with a small, sad smile, and he stared at her, still stunned. "May Hananja's inward sight be ever upon you," she said softly, the blessing's syllables rolling beautifully in her native tongue. Then she stroked his cheek with one hand. "I can't wish you peace, for when you return to your homeland, you must fight. But good luck." And then she got to her feet and left the garden. Ehuru stared after her for a long while, unsure of what to think, or whether to think at all. Eventually, though, it came to him that he felt better, more certain of the choices he'd made and the path he faced. In her own way, she had given him peace.
"Peace and luck to you as well, Sunandi of Kiswa," he said softly.
"And farewell." Chapter 33. There is the flood once per year, which marks experience. There is the full dreamer once per decade, which marks knowledge. There is the waking moon each morning, which marks contemplation. There is the river, ever present, which marks history. Wisdom. Traveling with the flow of the goddess's blood, it took 9 days to reach the outskirts of the Gujarine territories. Najiri spent most of those days doing his share of work on the merchant barge that bore them north toward home. When he was not working the long oar or fishing for their dinner, he whiled away the hours watching the Greenlands pass on either side of the river as they drifted along. Sometimes he played tete, a numbering game that required one to bluff and lie to win with the vessel's Kisawati crew. Unintentionally, he endeared himself to them by losing every round. Keeping busy helped Najiri avoid thinking of the future, although that went only so far. Sometimes he would look up and see Ehiru, who spent most of his own free hours standing at the prow of the barge, like a solemn statue, absorbed in whatever thoughts occupied his mind these days. At other times, the barge would float through a village, gliding past farmers preparing their fields for second planting, and children watering their beasts at the riverside. At such times, Najiri would be painfully struck by the overwhelming normality of what he saw. Beyond the fields, vast and terrible, conspiracies were in motion, armies on the move, monsters unleashed, death on a nightmarish scale threatening to swallow all the land. Yet for the common folk of Kiswa and Gujara, life went on as it had for centuries, unscathed by time or trouble. "This is what we fight for," Najiri would think in such moments, waving and smiling at a farm child or pretty maiden. This simple, ordered life was Hananja's truest peace, which priests of the Hedawa had devoted their lives to protecting for generations. This was what it truly meant to be a servant of Hananja. Then he would look at Ehiru and remember what awaited them in Gujara, and whatever peace he had found would vanish again. Thus did he pass the days as the villages became trade posts, and the trade posts became towns and smaller cities, and at last, on the 10th day, the towers and sprawl of Gujara's capital began to grow in the distance. The barge captain, a former Kisawati army officer, was sanguine about the risks as the crew prepared for the end of its journey. "I've smuggled more than my share of contraband through Gujara's gates," he said to Najiri as they stacked goods for the tax assessors. "You're no different from the rest, so relax." But Najiri could not relax. The sight of Gujara's familiar walls had stirred both homesickness and dread within him, and as they drew nearer, the dread grew. This was not dread for the inevitable duty he faced when the time came for Ehiru's final tithe. That particular misery was a steady, omnipresent thing. The new feeling was at once sharper and more alarming. Troubled and restless, he went to Ehiru, who manned the second long oar so that they could steer more precisely now that other vessels had begun to appear with greater frequency around them. All the river's traffic had increased as they approached Gujara's gateway port. The crew joked that soon they would be able to cross the river by stepping from boat to boat. "My heart flutters like a moth in my chest, brother," he murmured, taking hold of the pole to assist Ehiru. "I've never had a true seeing, but everything in me is frightened of returning to the city." "We have no reason to fear," Ehiru said, keeping his voice just as low. "No one is looking for us, or at least not here. Gujara has grown wealthy by treating traders kindly. We have only to be calm, and we should pass the gates with no incident."
"And once we pass the gates?"
"I would prefer to seek out our path brothers, but I don't know how we can reach them in the Hedawa without others, those I no longer trust like the superior, knowing of it." He looked briefly sour, then sighed. "For now we have surprise on our side. That will count for something." Najiri frowned, then inhaled.
You mean for us to go to Yanya Eon directly, then?
And do what? Gather the prince straight away? Without—
Yes, Najiri, Ehuru said, throwing him a hard look. I mean to do just that.
A gatherer destroys corruption. And power, if he must, Rabana had said. And he'd been right to remind Najiri to stop thinking like a servant caste. True peace required the presence of justice, not just the absence of conflict. So Najiri bit his lip, stifled the part of him that quailed at the idea of doing something so audacious, and set his mind to the task at hand. We should seek Sister Meliatwa, he said. She and the sisters have many allies around the city. They may be able to help us. Ehuru seemed to consider this. If she can get a message into the Hedua, or hide a person. He glanced at Najiri, and abruptly Najiri realized what he was thinking. Najiri scowled. You will not enter Yanya Eon without me. Ehuru opened his mouth to argue, then apparently thought better of it. He shook his head, eyes creasing with amusement. You have become a willful, rude apprentice, Najiri. I've always been so, brother. In spite of his mood, Najiri could not help grinning. But the moment was fleeting. Ehuru sobered and gazed out over the water. It wasn't difficult to guess the direction of his thoughts. Ehuru, brother. Najiri hesitated, then blurted. I've been thinking. Perhaps you could go before the Council of Paths. If you could face the Pranje again, within the peace of the Hedua. Ehuru took one hand off the oar and held it out. Even over the gentle bob of the barge, the tremor in his hand was pronounced. Najiri caught his breath, and Ehuru took hold of the oar once more, gripping it tightly to conceal the tremor. You see, Ehuru said. He turned his gaze to the river. His face was expressionless. Within another 4 days, I shall be as useless to you as I was in the desert, so I must act quickly. It had been 12 days since he'd killed the soldier, but already Ehuru's reservoir was empty again, had probably been empty for days, if his hands were that bad. Shaken, Najiri resumed turning the oar. As they drew nearer the city, the river traffic grew thicker yet, forcing them to slow and even stop on occasion as boats gathered into knots and lines leading up to the looming arch of the Blood Gate. The crew murmured in annoyance. Pulling himself out of sorrow enough to pay attention, Najiri watched as the captain called out to another boat nearby to ask why the traffic was so much worse than usual. Heard they're searching boats, the man replied with a shrug. For contraband, maybe, or smuggled goods? Who knows? Menedza's tongue, said one of the crewmen, frowning. Why in the Shadowlands would they tie up half the river with boat searches? Are they mad? It'll be moonset before they go home tonight. The captain glanced back at Ehuru and Najiri, though he spoke aloud to the whole crew. We've nothing to worry about, he said. Our cargo is strictly legal, this time. This provoked uneasy laughter that Najiri could not bring himself to share. Their boat inched closer to the network of piers and bridges that made up the gate. Soldiers wearing the gray loinskirts of the city guard swarmed along the piers like ants on both sides of the river. Najiri's dread grew as he glimpsed a fisherman standing rigid with fury, watching a soldier poke a spear butt through his day's catch. As they finally reached a pier, a man wearing the indigo-trimmed headcloth of a tax assessor approached the boat, flanked by two soldiers. Tie your boat for boarding, he said brusquely, and the barge's crew moved to comply. On the captain's orders, Najiri and Ehuru pushed the barge's anchor stone over the side, and then stood among the rest of the crew, watching. The tax assessor stepped into the boat with the ease of long practice, and began rummaging through the stacks of baskets and chests. The soldiers boarded less skillfully, but they moved with purpose as they came to where the crew stood. "State your name and business," said one.
While the other soldier took notes on a wide scroll, the crew members began to speak in turn. When Ehuru's turn came, he used the false name he'd given to Gehanu before the desert journey. Najiri did the same.
"You don't look Kisawati boy," the soldier said, narrowing his eyes.
"He was born in Gujara," the captain interjected smoothly. "My sister slept with a northerner and moved here when the family put her out. I've hired him on for the time being, since he isn't as lazy and shiftless as his father."
The soldier snorted at this and moved on down the line. Najiri exhaled in private relief. The captain winked at him.
Finally, the soldiers finished interviewing the crew.
"All right, then," said the one taking notes. "Turn and raise your arms, and then we'll be done."
The captain started.
"What is this? I have been riding the river between Kisawa and Gujara for 10 years and never—"
"New orders from Yanya Ian," the other soldier said. He spoke wearily, clearly having said the words many times before.
"There have been problems lately with spies and smugglers. You could have contraband hidden on you."
The captain's eyes widened in genuine affront.
"Are you mad? I—"
The soldier drew his sword and put it at the captain's throat in a blur of motion. The captain fell silent immediately.
"Orders from Yanya Ian," the soldier said again, speaking slowly and coldly now. "The prince's city obeys the prince's law."
From the corner of his eye, Najiri saw Ehuru bristle at this perversion of Hedewa doctrine. But of course they could not take the man to task for it. The crew members tensed as well, angry on behalf of their captain, but there was little they could do without jeopardizing his life.
"This can be quick and simple," said the soldier with the sword, with a hint of exasperation this time. "If you've done nothing wrong, you have nothing to fear."
One by one, the crew members obeyed. Najiri did the same, sighing at the indignity, but Ehuru turned only slowly. His eyes met Najiri's as they turned, and Najiri was startled to see that his mentor's jaw was tight with tension. "But why is he afraid? We have no contraband and barely enough money to be worth stealing, only—" And then he remembered. Their black loin drapes, hidden under their Kisawati clothing, their gatherer ornaments. His heart began to pound as the soldiers moved down the line, patting each crew member and pulling out weapons, money pouches, and the like. They were moving quickly, he noticed, with the one part of his mind that could still function through rising fear. His ornaments were in a pouch tucked into the band of his Kisawati loinskirt. "Let them miss it in their haste," he prayed silently. Perhaps they would feel them and dismiss them as dice, or tatet pieces, or just a boy's rock collection. The soldier's hand slapped roughly over his torso, and paused when they found the pouch. Through rising panic, Najiri felt the soldier tug the pouch out of his skirt. He heard the clatter of stones as the pouch was opened. When he heard the soldier's murmured oath, he knew they were lost. He glanced at Ehuru. There was only one chance. He mouthed the word, "Fight?" Ehuru's expression startled him, for the tension had been replaced by introspection. He shook his head minutely, then turned to face the soldiers. Swallowing, Najiri turned as well, unsurprised to see a sword leveled at his own throat.
"Gatherer Ehuru," said the soldier. His voice shook. "Gatherer apprentice Najiri. We were told to watch for you, but that you'd probably left the city."
"Obviously, we have returned," Ehuru said.
"You will come with us now," said the other soldier, nearly trembling in his excitement.
"Obviously, we shall," replied Ehuru. He lowered his arms and gazed down at the sword pointed at him, unafraid. "To Yanya Ian, I presume?" That was when Najiri understood. They had found a way into Yanya Ian after all.
Chapter 34. A gatherer may serve for as long as he passes her test. At the end of his service, he must offer up his soul's blood for her use. A gatherer belongs wholly to Hananja,
in life and in death. Law. Deep beneath Yanya Eon lay Yanya Ia Inank, the earthly thrones of the immortal kings. Row upon row of shelves lined the silent, winding corridors, each shelf housing the funeral urns of Gujara's past princes. Interspersed among the shelves were murals and embossed lacquer, depicting each ruler's time upon the throne of dreams, accompanied by formal pictorials delineating his or her name and accomplishments in Honokarek. In testament to the ambition of Gujara's founders, fewer than half of the shelves and walls had been filled in the 1,000 years of the city's existence. This, even though many shelves bore the urns of favored spouses, acclaimed soldiers, and other noteworthy folk granted the honor of resting alongside their rulers. It would take 1,000 more years for the catacombs to fill completely. But a temporary use for the empty space had been found, Ehuru saw. 3 small, hastily constructed cages stood against one of the blank walls, marring the catacomb's graceful architecture with ugly iron latticework. The sight filled Ehuru with affront, even as the soldiers pushed him into one of the cages and locked the door. Nijiri yelped as a soldier prodded him ungently into the cage after Ehuru. Their hands had not been bound, but the soldiers seemed well aware of the dangers of physical contact with a gatherer, using the butts of their spears to goad them along. Nijiri glared back at them and rubbed a fresh bruise on the back of one thigh as he crouched beside Ehuru. "What now, brother?" He sounded tense but calm, and Ehuru suspected that his tension was as much eagerness as fear. "Now we wait," Ehuru replied, examining their surroundings while the guards took up duty outside the cage. The cages were nothing more than flat grids of forged iron bars, tied with oiled lengths of twine to form a cube. The door was just a rough sheet of bronze, laid over an opening between the bars. The soldiers had to roll a carved wheelstone in front of the thing to seal the door. The whole structure had been tied to iron rings, set into a nearby wall of the catacombs, because clearly it would list wildly and perhaps fall apart otherwise, flimsy in appearance, but nevertheless difficult to escape. The cage nearest theirs was empty, but the furthest cage held one occupant. In the dim torchlight, Ehuru could make out no details of the huddled form, which might have been only a pile of rags for all that it moved. "Just wait?" Nijiri glanced toward the guards outside the cage, raising his eyebrows. They could not speak freely, but there was nothing to be said that their enemies did not already know. "The prince will be along soon enough," Ehuru said. It did not take long for him to be proven right. After an hour's passing or so, the soldiers snapped to attention, as the halls echoed suddenly with the rumble of chains and massive metal hinges. This was the mechanism which opened the heavy stone doors that sealed the catacombs during flood season. A gust of fresh air and the jingle of sandals heralded the prince's arrival, along with 4 of the Sunset Guard and the child who bore the aureole. 2 other child servants trailed behind the guards, each carrying an armload of heavy iron chains. The prince, resplendent in armor of bronze scales and a blood-red linen skirt, drew to a halt before the cage. "Ehuru," he said, smiling warmly, "I'm pleased to see you again." "I'm not pleased to see you, Aninket," Ehuru said. Aninket raised his eyebrows, smile fading. "I see the Kisawati have filled your head with lies before sending you back to us," he sighed. "If only you had killed the woman. I could have spared you so much suffering." "No more lies, Aninket," Ehuru snapped. "You have planned war, unprovoked and to suit your own greed, in violation of our every law. I name you corrupt."
"You name me nothing."
As quickly as the smile had vanished from Aninket's face,
Now a glare replaced it.
I should never have left you with the Hetawa, once I learned they had you. Better you had died with all the rest of our siblings than grow up to become another of their puppets.
He stepped closer to the cage, though still not within arm's reach. Ehru forced his tense muscles to relax.
Do you know what they did to our father, Ehru? I saw him grovel once, abject as the most humble servant caste, at the feet of a Hetawa priest. He begged, he wept, he promised to do whatever they asked, if only they would give him dream blood. And they gave it to him, laughing at his humiliation.
Beside Ehru, Najiri made a strangled noise. Ehru frowned, startled out of anger, disbelieving.
No, he said. Dream blood is used for healing.
Eninket threw back his head and laughed bitterly, the sound echoing throughout the tombs.
Healing!
He spun away, beginning to pace in his anger, fists tight at his sides.
Dream blood is the greatest secret of power in this land, Ehru. You and your path brothers collect hundreds of tithes every year. Do you honestly believe all of them are used just to comfort grieving widows and ease injured farmers' surgeries?
Ehru stared back at him, aware in that instant of a terrible, instinctive dread building in the back of his mind. This was not at all what he had expected. I do not want to know this, he thought, but Hananja's will could never be denied.
Dream blood is sweeter than any wine or aphrodisiac, more powerful than the purest timbalin, Eninket said.
He had stopped pacing. His voice was edged as a sword, but soft, too, like a gatherer's.
A single draft can heighten the mind, soothe the heart, and make the body impervious to pain, weariness, even age, at least for a short time.
But too much too often, and even the strongest man begins to crave it, to need it. He will do anything to get more. You know this better than anyone. He jerked his chin at Ehru, and Ehru flinched despite himself, and Eninket smiled.
Did you honestly believe the Hetawa would not take advantage of that, Ehru? Where do you think they get the resources to run the House of Children, to build statues out of rare nightstone, to buy your food and clothing? The elite of the city pay half their fortunes every year for the Hetawa's favor and for dream blood. His lip curled. A tithe for a tithe.
You lie! Ehru sprang to his feet and ran to the cage's bars, his whole body trembling. If he had been free in that moment, he would have killed Eninket with his bare hands just to stop the terrible words. But Eninket only sighed at the sight of Ehru's rage, his eyes filling with bleak pity. That, more than anything else, broke the back of Ehru's anger. It meant that Eninket was telling the truth. No. It isn't true. No.
The 44 years of our father's rule were a sham, my brother, Eninket said. He spoke heavily now, his anger gone.
Ehru's was too, numbed to nothingness.
He never made a decision without the Hetawa's approval, for fear they would cut him off and leave him to die in madness. The princes are figureheads. Gujara is truly ruled by the Hetawa. When I learned this, and saw what it did to our father, I swore I would break the cycle. I accepted their poisoned honey when I took up the Oriole. It was either that, or wake to find a gatherer in my bedchamber some night. I lived as their slave for years, but in secret, I searched for the means to free myself.
He gestured at the two chain-carrying servants. They bowed acquiescence and then went past him to the third cage, which the guards unlocked for them. Ehru heard whispers and the clack of metal, and a moment later they emerged, leading along the cage's occupant, a man who would have been twice their height if not for his hunched posture. He shuffled along between them, manacled at wrists and ankles.
An open, hooded cloak had been draped over his head and torso, though he wore only a stained loincloth underneath. Once the man must have been hale, but some illness or famine had sapped the vitality from his flesh and left him emaciated, the skin of his legs ashen and mottled with sores. Najiri sucked in a breath and stumbled back. His eyes widened, terrified. Ehru stared at the boy, then narrowed his eyes at the hunched figure as his mind filled with an ugly suspicion. "You hate me now," Endingket said to Ehru. His face was solemn. With one hand he plucked something from the waistband of his leather skirt. "I see that in your eyes, even though they are the ones you should hate. But I've never hated you, Ehru, no matter what you might think. I mean to use you, for they've made you into a weapon and dropped you at my feet. But know that I do it out of necessity, not malice." He gestured again. One of the children reached up to remove the manacled man's ragged robe. And then it was Ehru's turn to stagger away, so overcome with shock and revulsion that had there been anything in his stomach, he would have vomited it up in helpless reaction. "Una une," he whispered. Una une did not respond. Once he had been Ehru's mentor, oldest and wisest of the gatherers who had served Gujara for the past decade. Now he was a slack-jawed apparition who gazed unfocused into what was surely the most twisted of the nightmare lands. There was nothing of the Una Une Ehru had known in the creature's eyes. There was nothing of humanity in those eyes. Not any longer. "He isn't at his best right now," Aninket said, still in that gatherer gentle voice. "His mind, what remains of it, comes and goes. I thought at first to use a sharer, easier to control, and the deterioration wouldn't have been as severe. But the scrolls warned that only a gatherer would have the power I needed. So I bribed a sentinel to steal Una Une away as he meditated on the night before his final tithe." Through shadows, Ehru heard Najiri's voice. "The superior said Una Une gave his tithe directly to the sharers." The boy sounded more shaken than Ehru had ever heard him, his voice quavering like an old man's. The Reaper's attack had left its mark on him. "I stood attendance on his funeral pyre with the other acolytes. I watched him burn." "You watched a body burn," Aninket snapped. "Some pauper buried by the Hedua, I don't know. The superior helped me hide the kidnapping when I threatened to tell the gatherers about his corrupt use of dream blood. Perhaps he thought to cut me off in retaliation, or perhaps it simply never occurred to him to wonder why I wanted a broken gatherer. Who knows? In any case, by the time he discovered my intent, it was too late. Una Une was mine." Ehru wept. He could not help it, witnessing the ruin of a man he had loved more than his father, more than all his brothers and sisters, more than even Hananja herself. He pressed himself against the hard, cold wall at the back of the cage, because that was the only way he could keep his feet. "My path brother, my mentor, I have failed you. We have all failed you so badly." "Why?" It was a hoarse whisper, all he could manage. Beyond the cage, Una Une twitched, reacting either to Ehru's voice or to some conjuration of his broken mind. "Una Une has no limit now," Aninket replied. "He takes and takes, far more than he ever could as a gatherer. Much of the magic is consumed by his hunger, but more than enough remains for my needs." He turned to Una Une and lifted his hand, wrapping the object in it with his fingernail. Ehru jerked in reflexive response when he heard the faint whine of a Jangisa stone. Una Une lifted his... No, the Reaper lifted its head slowly, blinking at Aninket as if trying to see him from a great distance. "Come, brother," Aninket said to the creature. Fixing the stone to his breastplate, he held out his hands in a posture that was sickeningly familiar. Like the Hedawa's statue of the goddess, Ehuru realized with sinking horror. Or a sharer awaiting the transfer of a gatherer's collected tithes. After a moment, the reaper shuffled to Aninket's feet and knelt, taking his hands. No, Ehuru whispered. But there was no mistaking the reaper's posture, a palsied mockery of the tithing ceremony. Nor could Ehuru deny the way Aninket suddenly caught his breath and stiffened, his face alighting in all-too-familiar ecstasy. And even as Ehuru wept, a surge of pure, envious lust shot through him. That was enough to send him to his knees, dry-retching over the dusty stones. He felt Najiri's hands on him, trying to pull him up, or at least soothe him, but that was no help. By the time he finally lifted his head, blinking away tears and gasping for breath, the warped ceremony had ended. Aninket's shadow fell over him, right in front of the bars and within arm's reach at last. But so sickened was Ehuru that he could not muster the will to attack. "I tell you this because you deserve the truth after so many lies, Ehuru," Aninket said. His speech was faintly slurred, his eyes still hazy with lingering pleasure. "Dream blood has more power than you could ever imagine. You know what a single life can do. What you don't know, what the Hedawa has spent 1,000 years hiding, is that the more lives one takes, and the more dream blood one absorbs, the greater the transformations it triggers in body and soul." He put a hand on the iron lattice and leaned forward, speaking softly and emphatically. "Take enough lives all at once, and the result is immortality." Ehuru frowned up at him, uncomprehending. Najiri's hands tightened on Ehuru's back. "Impossible," Ehuru heard him say. Aninket gave them a lazy smile. Above it, his eyes glittered like citrines in the torchlight. "It was so for our founder, Inanru," he said. "Great Inanru. Brilliant as a god, blessed by Hananja. Did you never wonder how one man could accomplish so much in a mortal lifetime? 100 years after his first experiments, he had not aged, did not die. More and more faithful flocked to the banner of Hananja as they saw him and realized the power of her magic. The Kisawati protectors finally banished his followers, and outlawed narcomancy not because they feared the magic, but because they feared him. Inanru had made himself all but a god. They had to do something to destroy his influence. Lies, snapped Najiri. The Hedawa would have known of this. There would be records. The lore would have been chiseled into every wall. The Hedawa had its own secrets to keep, Aninket said, smiling coldly. Ehuru fixed his gaze on Unaune, who sat slumped and quiescent at Aninket's feet. "Because 100 years after his banishment from Kiswa, right in the Hedawa's Hall of Blessings, Inanru finally died when his own priests killed him. They, too, had come to fear him, because his power had only grown in the time since, and with it, his greed. So they killed him, and they rewrote Hedawa ritual, rewrote history itself, to make the world forget such magic existed." Aninket leaned down, so that Ehuru had no choice but to look at him. "But I have found Inanru's scrolls, brother, and now I know. A reaper is the key." He reached out and caressed Unaune's bowed head with a tenderness that had nothing to do with affection. "When our armies and those of Kiswa meet on the battlefield," Aninket continued, "their bloodlust and pain will draw the reaper's hunger like a moth to flame. But this moth will devour the flame, and through him so shall I. Unaune will die at last, burned out by the power. But I shall become as eternal as a god." He paused, then gazed at Ehuru for a long, solemn moment.
Then, however, I will need a new reaper.
Ehuru's blood turned to stone. With a soft